Come now to oral questions. The first in the name of the Honourable Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Disability Issues. Does she stand by her statement regarding funding for disability support services? Quote, they have been trying to deal with that and we have been working with them to deal with that since they alerted me in December, unquote. If so, on what date was she first alerted to these funding issues?
The Honourable Penny Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I do. I also stand by my statement yesterday that there has been no reduction in funding for disabled people and no disabled people will lose access to funding for essential services, equipment or support. The Ministry is clarifying what this funding can be spent on to ensure it goes towards the direct needs of the disabled person. Parents and carers will still be able to use the support budget to pay for within-region travel and essential equipment and devices. We have inherited a situation from the previous government where insufficient funding was provided for the policy settings that were in place. We are taking steps to address that short-term issue, but we will directly, clearly need to address the longer-term issue as well, and I'm taking advice on that. The first I was alerted to the potential issue was December 15, but at that time the Ministry believed that they could manage potential overruns. And Mr. Speaker, I want to offer my sincere apologies to the disabled community. We absolutely accept that the engagement with the community over this change was inadequate and has created unnecessary uncertainty. We have taken that criticism on board and we will do better in the future.
Great. On what dates did she first advise the Finance Minister of a forecast overspend in disability support services that would require a change to the purchasing rules and equipment and modification services?
Mr. Speaker, in December, the Ministry believed that they could manage this overrun. In subsequent months, that amount continued to trend towards an overspend. The context of this, Mr. Speaker, is that since 2018, the number of people accessing disability supports has increased by around 50% compared to population growth of 8.5% over that same period. The previous Labor government was aware of this increase, but did nothing to address the sustainability of the disability support service budget.
Okay.
But I assure the community that no disabled person will lose access to funding for essential services, equipment or support.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, the Honourable Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
The question was very clearly about a date. What date did she advise the Finance Minister? Her answer was long but went nowhere near that.
Minister might like to consider the question again.
The Minister and myself have been discussing budget process over a number of months, and the Minister of Finance has been very clear that there will be additional funding to maintain crucial frontline disability services. She gave that answer in the House yesterday.
A point of order, the Honourable Dr.
If the Minister doesn't know or can't recall, she should say so. But that again didn't answer the question, which was very clearly what date did she inform the Minister of the cost overruns?
Well, I think that the addressing of the question is accepted on the basis that she indicated over a number of months have been talking about increased funding.
Mr. Speaker, on what date did she first request a pre-budget commitment for additional funding for Faikaha to retain flexibility of funding for disability support services?
As I've said in my previous answers. The 15th of December was when I first was alerted to the issue. This is a matter that had been known by the previous Labor government and nothing had been done. The ministry thought that they could manage the overrun at that time. From this year onwards, they have been watching that fund engagement trend upwards, and I have been in discussion with the Minister of Finance to do with the budgetary process.
Point of order.
What? Was you a point of order? Okay, point of order, the Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
Once again, that the Minister gave a long amount of information about the problem, but didn't actually answer the question, which was, when did she seek additional pre-budget funding?
Well, with all due respect to your position, the question itself makes an assumption about a process, and therefore I think any answer the Minister gave could be reasonable if it talked about matters that would relate to a budget process, which she did. The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Does the Minister, is the Minister saying that she first learned about the cost blowout here on the 15th of December, and that prior to that no fire warning had come to any Minister in charge of that portfolio?
I understand that the previous government were made aware of the issues. And on the 15th of December, I was made aware of the issues. At that time, the ministry felt they could deal with it, but the trend continued upwards, and therefore I had ongoing discussions with the Minister of Finance.
Did she advise Cabinet or the Prime Minister's office that Faikaha would be making changes to remove flexibility of funding? If so, on what date did she do so?
Faikaha have been dealing with a fund that the previous government had no settings, no regulations around. That has left Faikaha in a situation where they were dealing with a fund that absolutely increased enormously over the last few years. They have been trying to work with this. We are now working with them, and we also will be working with the disabled community around putting settings in place to ensure that the funding is directed and focused towards the needs of the disabled person. It is regrettable that there was no settings put in place by the previous government to assist Faikaha with the management of this fund.
Did she or her office sign out a briefing to approve the changes that took effect on 18th of March, and if so, when?
Again, I answered this question yesterday. No. On the 14th of March, I was advised that these changes would be implemented from the 18th of March. I absolutely regret that we did not have fulsome engagement with the disabled community, and that our communications could have been much better and could have not contributed to some of the anxiety that has occurred in the disabled community.
A point of order.
Again, the question was not when it was brought to her about the changes that took effect on 18th March. It was very specific. Did she or her office sign out a briefing approving those changes, and it wasn't addressed?
I think that's a fair point. The question talks about was the briefing on the changes. Look, ask the question again. Sorry. So it's not my job to interpret the question.
Sorry?
Hard enough as it is.
Did she or her office sign out a briefing to approve the changes that took effect on 18th March? If so, when?
Again, as I said both today and yesterday, on the 14th of March, I signed the briefing that the implementation would occur on Monday the 18th.
What does she say to the mother who emailed her office and said, once, I quote, once or twice a year I have taken myself off for a night when I've been able to find someone to come to my house and look after the children. I do not claim carer support for this, but have utilized our respite funding. That's two nights a year I get to sleep undisturbed, that I get to sleep in past 7 a.m. Is this unreasonable? Unquote.
Mr. Speaker, the access to that funding under the settings that were there previously, absolutely nothing wrong was done by the person who accessed that. What we are saying is we need to look at the settings to ensure that the funding support goes to the person with the disability.
Thank you. Come now to question number two. Question number two, in the name of Greg Fleming.
And to Manga Otafari, my question is to the Minister of Finance. Has she seen any recent reports on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker, great question. Yes. This morning, Statistics New Zealand released the latest GDP figures. These showed that real GDP fell 0.1% in the December quarter of last year. Looking a little further back, the release also shows that GDP fell in the December quarter of 2022, the March quarter of 2023, and the September quarter of 2023. So 2022 and 2023 were certainly difficult years for the economy and therefore difficult years for New Zealanders and their families.
Where is the New Zealand economy right now?
Mr. Speaker, the member raises a good point because GDP is reported some way after the event, which the release today is about what happened last year. And what I can tell members is that when I talk to people and to businesses around the country, they are definitely doing it hard. But economic conditions will improve. GDP is expected to pick up this year, although strong population growth will limit per capita growth. In next week's budget policy statement, the Treasury will say more about its current view of the economy.
Supplementary, Greg Fleming.
Does today's GDP release have any impact on this year's budget?
Mr. Speaker, the government's plans for the budget have not changed. These include delivering tax reductions to provide cost of living relief to New Zealanders who have seen no change in personal income tax rates and thresholds for 14 years. And can I reinforce to members that those tax reductions will be funded by reprioritisation, savings and new revenue measures, and this package of measures will not add to debt. Mr. Speaker, I'd make an observation about those who oppose tax reduction. When the economy is going well, they say tax reduction must not happen because it will be inflationary. When the economy is not going well, they say tax reduction must not happen because we can't afford it. The truth, Mr. Speaker, is members opposite believe the government can spend money better than New Zealanders can on their own families. Well, I disagree.
He pata anō.
Greg Fleming.
Does today's release have an impact on other government activities?
Mr. Speaker, declining GDP in the December quarter does reinforce the importance of the government's plan to restore fiscal discipline to public spending and to drive more economic growth. I've said a lot about fiscal discipline in the House recently, and last Friday I gave a speech to the Auckland Business Chamber setting out the government's growth strategy. This government knows that a strong economy determines our standard of living, job and business opportunities, and the quality of public services. We are focused on rebuilding the economy after years of economic mismanagement.
Does she agree with Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, who said that the Sunday Star Times is, quote, right, of course, end quote, when they reported that the government is facing a fiscal hole of $5.6 billion?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Deputy Prime Minister is right and would prefer that the member opposite, I'm sure, quoted him in the full context. Because what is true is that our government has inherited a fiscal hole from a previous government who had in place a structural deficit, spending beyond the country's means. What is not the case is that Vernon Small's figure bears any relation to the affordability of our tax package. And I can reassure the member opposite with that when the families in Auckland Central get their tax reduction, get their childcare tax rebate, they can be sure it will be funded responsibly through reprioritisation. And I look forward to her explaining to them why she would stop them getting it.
Supplementary.
Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Minister of Finance as to whether she's received, apart from the 100,000 ways of spending the taxpayers' money, one idea from over there on how to make the taxpayers' money?
Well, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, it's, you've got,
well, let me give it a go.
Yeah. You'd love to give it a go, but you've got no responsibility for any ideas that may or may not exist on the other side of the House.
Mr. Speaker, there's no prescription as to where the Minister of Finance might get advice or submissions from. She gets them from all around the world. She gets them from the IMF. She gets them from the OECD. So why are you proscribing it? It's a very reasonable question. They'll hate the answer. That's the only problem with it.
Well, let me hear it again. Ask the question again.
Can I ask the Minister of Finance, alongside the 100,000 ways that she has received by way of advice to spend the taxpayers' money, has she received one idea on how the taxpayers may receive or make some money from those parties over there?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Deputy Prime Minister makes two very good points. There have been occasions where the member opposite and I have shared ideas. The Unit Title Reform Bill is an example of that. But the Deputy Prime Minister also highlights something very important, which is those who wish to spend a country's money should probably also be thinking of ideas for making it. And on this side of the House, we are resolutely pro-growth, pro-development, anti-red tape, and I wish the Greens would join us in that mission.
Chloe, Swarbrick, just wait for a minute. Okay.
Would the Minister consider addressing that structural deficit in the economy which she just cited through recommendations from the Treasury or even the likes of the IMF, which recent reports stated, and I quote, we could achieve a more efficient, equitable tax system with a comprehensive capital gains tax?
No, Mr. Speaker. No country has ever taxed its way to prosperity. And how wrong-headed is that the answer to every economic problem that member ever sees is always tax them more.
Chloe Swarbrick.
Does the Minister then disagree with the consistent advice from the Treasury that we would have a more productive economy with the implementation of a capital gains tax, fixing the incentives which currently see far too much money flowing into bidding up house prices?
Mr. Speaker, I disagree with quite a lot of the Treasury advice. And I think I also agree with quite a lot of the Treasury advice. And what I think the member opposite should be very careful about is cherry-picking Treasury advice, because I can tell her, Treasury don't agree with her anti-growth, pro-regulation perspective. They know that that's a recipe for disaster in our economy.
Come now to question number three. The name of the Honourable Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Finance, does she stand by all her statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I do, in the context in which they were given. I particularly stand by my statement that hardworking New Zealanders deserve tax relief. Given that data today confirms our economy has experienced a double-dip recession, I know those hardworking New Zealanders will be appreciative of soon being able to keep more of their money.
Supplementary. On what date did she decide not to progress a pre-budget funding commitment for Waikaha, as she told staff yesterday?
That's not what I told staff yesterday, but let me clarify the situation for the member. The Ministry of Disabled People had been invited to submit for cost pressures as part of Budget 2024, as we view the services they provide as critical frontline services and intended to provide them more funding in the budget, and they did so with the Minister. Subsequent to that request, I was advised in early March that there was a risk of the Disability Services, Whaikaha, exceeding its appropriation. Treasury advised me at that time that this could be dealt with through the usual budget process, and obviously yesterday it became clear there are more immediate issues.
Supplementary. Why did the change to disability support happen without warning or consultation with those affected when she made the decision to progress it as a part of a normal budget process?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I can't speak to that because I was not involved in making those decisions.
Does the Minister stand by her comments to staff yesterday? On balance, we got to was that we would just make decisions as part of a normal budget process.
That's correct, Mr. Speaker, because what I was advised that was that Whaikaha had sufficient funding to make it through so long as we made budget decisions on the timeline that we were planning, and so long as we did agree to additional funding on that timeline. We had been clear that we were providing significant additional funding. We were clear that the decision would be finalised by Cabinet in time for that to give Whaikaha security of funding going forward.
Supplementary. Why did she decide to increase the level of cuts required of Whaikaha to 7.5% rather than the 6.5% she campaigned on and it was a requiring of other agencies, given she received a briefing from the Minister of Disabilities in late 2023?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I would just assure the member that the Ministry for Disability Services is expected to get vast orders of magnitude more in additional funding for frontline services, vast orders of magnitude more than any small changes they make to ensure their back office is more efficient. We haven't exempted them from the process we are asking all government agencies to do because we are conscious every dollar that is saved by not spending it on another policy advisor, administrative person, consultant or contractor is a dollar that can actually go to support people with disabilities.
Supplementary. Does she stand by her statement that she was surprised by this decision? And if so, is that because the Minister of Disability Issues never alerted her to the situation, or does she just not read the paper setting out the rationale for an early decision?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes.
Come now to question number four in the name of Ricardo Mendes-March.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Immigration and asks, when, if ever, can Palestinian New Zealanders expect her response to their repeated calls for a special humanitarian visa to bring their family members safely to New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Erica Stanford.
First, let me start by acknowledging the unimaginable humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Our thoughts are with all Palestinian New Zealanders who have family and friends there. The government, along with our international partners, are closely monitoring the evolving situation in Gaza. I receive weekly updates on the visas issued and have regular conversations with officials on what other countries are doing. At this time, the evidence is that a special humanitarian visa is not a solution to the current crisis. For example, I'm told that Canada, the only country that have created a special visa, has received 986 applications, and only on January the 1st they opened that, and only 14 of those people have managed to complete secondary screening. It is heartbreaking to hear reports like the one this morning on RNZ of a man whose ex-wife and two children have visitor visas that we granted in December who have still not been able to get out of Gaza. I do not want to give false hope to people that a visa will enable them to leave Gaza. As and when the situation changes in Gaza, we will reconsider our position.
Which option would enable more lives to be saved? The status quo or creating a special humanitarian visa to reunite family members of Palestinian New Zealanders with those that are still in Gaza?
Mr. Speaker, I'll reiterate what I said. New Zealand has already been issuing visitor visas to members of family members of Palestinians here in New Zealand, and we have not been able to get them out. Unfortunately, the situation is a border situation, and simply issuing visas like the Canadians have done like we have done, will not mean we can get people out of Gaza. As and when the situation changes in Gaza, we will reconsider our position, and we are monitoring the situation daily.
Are you aware that since October last year, only 10 visitor visa applications by Palestinians have been granted, whilst 13 have been rejected, and that 7 times more visas are still being granted to Israeli nationals and Palestinian nationals when both of them are supposedly prioritised?
Mr. Speaker, I don't know if the member has up-to-date numbers. I believe that the numbers of people who have been issued visitor visas are higher than that. The issue that we have, as I've said, is that people are not able to get out of Gaza. Many of the visas that we have issued are for people who are still waiting to get out and cannot get out.
Supplementary.
Ricardo Mendes March.
Has she requested advice on options to reunite family members of Palestinian New Zealanders beyond just monitoring the situation?
Mr. Speaker, I have asked for that. I asked for it very early on, and I was advised that we have set up a special dedicated number of staff at Immigration New Zealand who are processing visitor visas for family members. We have a special dedicated inbox. We are expediting those, and we are taking humanitarian situation into consideration when we are granting those visas. But the situation remains like the man who was in the Herald, RNZ this morning, who has an ex-wife and children in Gaza. We have issued them visas, and they cannot leave. As and when the situation changes, we will reconsider our position.
Tim Costley.
What is the government doing in response to the situation in Gaza?
Mr. Speaker, Immigration New Zealand has, as I said, a specialist team working on applications. Since the 7th of October, we've received 71 applications from Palestinian nationals around the world. Of these, we believe 15 applications are from people who, to the best of our knowledge, may have been in Gaza at the time of their application or shortly before lodging. We've issued 7 visas to people who are immediate family members of New Zealand citizens or permanent residents. And I would encourage any Palestinian New Zealander who has immediate family members in Gaza that they would like to travel to New Zealand to go to the Immigration New Zealand website to apply for a visa, which will be promptly assessed by the specialist team. Unfortunately, as I've said, that does not guarantee them a way out of Gaza. As we have seen, we have already done this, and many of those people we have issued visas to are still unable to leave. The New Zealand government has also provided a total of $15 million in humanitarian assistance, including through the World Food Programme, UNICEF and the International Committee of the Red Cross to address the urgent humanitarian situation in Gaza.
Ricardo Mendes-March.
Thank you. Does she agree with MP Erica Stanford, who said 14 days after the Russian invasion of Ukraine that, quote, desperate Ukrainians in New Zealand have been unable to rescue wider family members because of Immigration Minister Chris Fifield has not created a special pathway to let them come to New Zealand? And if so, will she afford the same urgency to Palestinian New Zealanders who are urgently waiting to be reunited with their families?
Mr. Speaker, I do agree with that member in opposition. And the reason I do is because those people in Ukraine were able to leave. They were able to get on a plane and get to New Zealand. The situation in Gaza is that they cannot leave. And I am not going to be issuing visas, which is issuing false hope, for people who, on a great scale, who cannot leave. But as and when the situation changes, we will reconsider our position.
What further actions, beyond monitoring the situation, has the minister explored?
Nothing.
Mr. Speaker, as I said in my primary answer, every single week in my bag I ask for updates on the visas that have been issued to Palestinian nationals. I ask for an update on each individual family situation so that I can see who has been issued a visa and who has been able to leave. I have regular conversations with my officials on what other countries are doing, which is why I was able to tell you about, the member about the situation with the Canadian visa, which is the only country in the world that has issued a humanitarian visa and has not been able to get people out. We are monitoring the situation. We are asking about what other countries are being able to do so that we can closely follow them if and when the situation changes.
Does she agree with Minas Al-Ansari, speaking for Kiwi Palestinians with family in Gaza, who said that, quote, right now our family members are being killed and we are helpless to save them? One member of her community has lost 120 members of their family. If Erica Stanford, this national-led government, had granted special humanitarian visas early, as was done for Ukraine, there is absolutely no doubt lives would have been saved. And if so, how many more lives need to be lost before she considers a visa?
The last part of that question is not acceptable. Just withdraw that last part, because you can't ask someone to comment on a quote and then say, if so, doesn't work. So put it grammatically correctly to the House.
Sure.
But don't repeat the whole question, it's too long.
I can cut the quote then, but does she agree with Minas Al-Ansari, who said, quote, right now our families are being killed and we're helpless to save them.
The last part, just rephrase the very last part of the question.
Does she agree with Minas Al-Ansari, who said, quote, if Erica Stanford, this national-led government, had granted special humanitarian visas early, as was done for Ukraine, there is absolutely no doubt lives would have been saved.
That's the end of the question. You can't rephrase it. You're not carrying on with it.
There's a quote here. I'm trying to shorten it as much as I can.
Get it right. Just take the last part off. It's pretty clear, pretty simple.
Yeah, I'll just repeat the quote without the last bit then. Does she agree with Minas Al-Ansari, speaking for Kiwi Palestinians with family in Gaza?
No, I'm sorry. That's it. Finished. Thank you. Move now to...
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, yes.
How is it that a member is supposed to repeat the end of a question by reframing that whilst not offering the question in its full context?
You can't ask a question for an opinion when, in fact, you are finishing the question by inferring that the content is irrefutable, which effectively the words, if so, do. I asked him to change it several times.
I hear that, Mr. Speaker, and I guess just for sake of clarity for the House, then it would be the most kind of due process for the question in its full.
It's never been a problem for others to correct a small part at the end. I'm just not happy that we're now trifling with the House when other people are able to comply with those
Speaking to
requirements.
The point of order. Sorry, Mr. Speaker. So just to clarify in good faith, what you had asked me was to shorten the quote altogether, which I tried to do. None of the quotes that I had tried to repeat while shortening it were outside of what I had repeated. So I tried to cut the second bit and just repeat the question as it was. My intention is absolutely not to trifle with the House. It is to comply with what was requested of me.
Well, your intention is not meeting its intent. Can we just drop the if so part of the question?
Done.
Oh. I can do that.
Good. Thank you. The Hansard will record that. The Minister may like to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Look, I would say that, of course, the situation is unimaginable. But I would say that, unfortunately, the comments that man made are not true. We know that people in Palestine who have temporary visas to get out have not been able to get out. We granted visas in December and people still are unable to get out. It is unfortunately not a visa issue, it is a border issue, and as I've said a number of times, if that changes, we will reconsider our position.
Thank you. Question number 5, the name of Tim van der Molen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Trade. What actions has the government taken to support New Zealand trade?
The Honourable Tom McLeay.
Today the House will complete the final legislative processes required to bring the New Zealand-European Union Free Trade Agreement into force on the 1st of May, many months earlier than expected. This legislation is being passed in a record time of 7 weeks so that New Zealand businesses can realise benefits as soon as possible. In particular, this early entry into force date means our kiwi fruit industry will see $43 million worth of tariff savings this year. We also estimate that 35,000 tonnes of onions will be exported to the EU after the 1st of May, saving our onion exporters $3 million per season. Without this early entry into force, both the kiwi fruit and onion growers would have missed the season's exports and paid many tens of millions of dollars worth of tariffs.
Supplementary.
Sam Uppendahl.
Why has the government moved so quickly to get this agreement into force?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government's drive to get the legislation passed in record time is to see the immediate tariff savings of $100 million per year on New Zealand's exports from day one. For the first day of implementation, duties will be removed from 91% of goods exported, and a wide range of sectors will see these immediate benefits. 99.5% of fish and seafood trade will enter tariff-free from day one, as will 97% of New Zealand's wine and Manuka honey exports. The EU has completed its ratification process last year. It's now up to us to deliver and do our part to bring the agreement into force, and that's what the House will do today.
Supplementary.
Catherine Webb.
What benefits will New Zealanders see as a result of this agreement?
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand will remove all tariffs on imports originating from the EU. New Zealand consumers and businesses will benefit from access to cheaper products imported from the EU on a range of goods, including footwear, apparel, cosmetics, furniture, chocolate, kitchen appliances, machinery, motorhomes, forklifts and some agricultural goods. The EU is our fourth largest services trading partner worth $4.4 billion. We estimate there will be significant savings between 10 to 20% in the costs for New Zealand service exporters that the EU that trade with the EU. The economic gains from the FTA will help to soften the impact of the cost of living increases for New Zealanders and helps to rebuild our economy.
Supplementary.
Tim Venable.
How was it possible to get this legislation through so quickly?
Oh, great question.
Well, the EU-NZ FTA officially enters into force on the first day of the second month after the legislation has passed through the House. Therefore, it was vital we fast-track this legislation through Parliament as quickly as possible. I'd like to recognise the work done by the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Select Committee and members from all parties who work collaboratively to speed up the process while still hearing the views from all submitters. I'd also like to recognise the considerable efforts of the Honourable Damien O'Connor and all parties in this House for agreeing to progress the ratification of the EU FTA legislation so quickly.
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, given the importance and the value of this agreement and the passage of this legislation, if this legislation is so important, why did the government prioritise the removal of smoking protection over the passage of this legislation?
Mr. Speaker, it's no wonder that member is no longer the minister responsible. But what I would like to do is thank him for his hard work on an agreement that will help deliver for all New Zealanders and recognise how hard it must be to be a Minister of Trade in a Labor government.
Here we go. Come now to question number 6 in the name of the Honourable Dr. Asha Birrell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, does he stand by all his statements and actions?
Speaker.
The Honourable Matt Ducey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On behalf of the Minister of Health, yes, in the context in which they were given, including his action of congratulating the new Minister of Mental Health on his great announcement this morning of rolling out mental health peer support workers in emergency departments.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker. Why did he issue a statement on 29 November that said Labor's smoke-free changes would have resulted in an illicit market for tobacco when he had been advised that the evidence did not support that statement?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Health, I take a range of advice, and if that member had read her own regulatory impact statement from the legislation she passed in 2021, she would have seen that advice.
That's right.
Mr. Speaker, would the member, can the minister recall that the regulatory impact statement said that the illicit market in tobacco was decreasing at a time when New Zealanders had the highest price of one of the highest prices of cigarettes in the world? And if so, how can he justify his decision to make a statement that the smoke-free laws that Labor put in place would increase the illicit market?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Health, I can justify that statement from the advice in her own regulatory impact statement in 2021 that said, quote, any additional actions that will reduce the supply, availability and appeal of smoked tobacco products will add to the incentives to import illicit tobacco products.
How is it truthful to repeatedly claim that the legislation will grow the black market when, subsequent to the regulatory impact statement and before the Minister made his statement on the 29th of November, he had been advised that there was no evidence to support that claim?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Health, I receive a range of advice, including another statement from that regulatory impact statement in 2021 that said organised syndicates were involved in illicit tobacco trade.
Just make the point that it's not appropriate to, in a question, infer that any member of the House is less than truthful. There is another process for that.
Is it correct that documents reveal his office has been involved with undermining smoke-free policies, while he has said to health workers this policy has nothing to do with him?
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Health, what is correct is I've received a range of advice from many different stakeholder groups, including the submissions from stakeholders during the process when that bill went to Select Committee, such as the Food and Grocery Council submitted to the Health Select Committee that limiting retail could create significant additional opportunities for organised crime, including gangs.
Come now to question number 7, in the name of Carl Bates.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Mental Health and asks, what recent announcements has he made regarding mental health?
Honourable Matt Ducey.
Mr Speaker, today I'm pleased to announce a new mental health and addiction peer support service in hospital emergency departments. The service will see peer support workers embedded within EDs to provide additional support for those with mental health needs and their families in a time of need. It will also help connect people in crisis to community support. I've heard from many in the sector who want to see peer support specialists playing a greater role in helping to address some of the challenges faced by our mental health services, including using their established workforce to start taking the pressure off our specialist services in EDs.
Carl Bates.
What actions is the government taking to grow the peer support workforce?
Mr Speaker, today I also announced a $1 million workforce fund over 2 years that's been set up to provide Level 4 New Zealand Certificate in Health and Wellbeing SEB peer support training and specific training for working in EDs. Peer support specialists play a vital role within this workforce, and it's essential that we put in place specific initiatives to grow and support them.
Supplementary.
Carl Bates.
What impact will these new services have on emergency departments?
Mr Speaker, I've been advised that between 13 and 14,000 people present annually to EDs with mental health issues. This service will help provide timely mental health and addiction support for those in need whilst helping relieve pressure on ED staff. This service will also support police who respond to a number of mental health call-outs and in many cases have to wait with the patient for several hours in ED before they can be handed over to a mental health specialist. Embedding peer support workers in ED will allow for a warm handover from police, which will mean they can get back on the street faster to keep our community safe.
Supplementary.
Ingrid Leary.
Will the Minister commit to appropriate levels of care for people experiencing mental health distress from when they arrive in the emergency departments, continuously and until after they leave, by peer support and medical workers, to ensure this program keeps people safe and can't be exploited to gain waiting time targets for ED?
Mr Speaker, what I can commit to is this government will get more money out of the beehive to the grassroots NGOs that are ready to respond to the needs in mental health. That's exactly what we've done today with uncommitted funding that they left sitting in the beehive.
Carl Bates.
What feedback has he received from the mental health sector?
Mr. Speaker, today's announcement has been described by the sector as a positive move, with the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission saying people who are experiencing mental distress who arrive at EDs will be supported while they wait. This will be positive for both the department and people seeking help. The peer support workforce has a lot to offer, and it's encouraging to see the expansion of these roles.
Question number 8, in the name of Todd Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Courts and asks, what recent policy announcements has she made?
I recently announced the introduction of the Courts Remote Participation Amendment Bill to Parliament, contributing to the Government's 100-day commitment to enable more virtual participation in court proceedings. This bill enables the use of audio-visual link technology, which proved invaluable during the COVID-19 pandemic, to support access to justice and a safer option to attend court for victims.
Supplementary. Will introducing audio-visual link courts contribute to more efficient court proceedings?
Honourable Nicole McKee.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Enabling audio-visual link technology in court proceedings offers increased efficiency by providing flexibility in how parties participate. This flexibility may reduce the time and costs associated with attending court in person, including travel expenses and transport security costs.
Supplementary. Will the introduction of audiovisual link courts support victims?
Mr. Speaker, yes. The use of audiovisual links in our courts will enable victims of crime to remotely observe criminal trials if suitable technology is available and remote viewing is deemed appropriate by a judicial officer or a court registrar. This will allow victims to avoid potential re-traumatisation and intimidation often associated with attending court in person.
Supplementary. What will this government do to ensure the use of audiovisual links in New Zealand's courts is fit for purpose for the future?
Mr. Speaker, Cabinet has endorsed a first principles review of the Courts Remote Participation Act 2010, given the significant advancements in audio-visual link technology since the Act was passed in 2010. This review will inform possible ways of enhancing and updating audio-visual link capabilities within our court system. The results of this review will be assessed later on this year.
Question number 9, in the name of Greg O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Veterans. Does he stand by his statement that the Veterans Independence Program is a great thing to be able to do? If so, does he support Veterans Affairs' move to restrict access to the Veterans Independent Program?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Pink.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the first part of the question, yes. To the second part of the question, also yes. I strongly support the prioritisation of existing resources that are available, particularly to those ex-service personnel who have been injured or become ill as a result of their service to New Zealand. As the situation currently stands, as we inherited, it takes, for example, 361 days on average for a disablement pension claim to be processed and provided. Clearly that's not acceptable, and anything that we can do to improve the situation for those veterans is not only the moral thing to do, it is the legally required course of action in accordance with the Veterans Support Act.
Supplementary question. Does he agree with former Minister Craig Foss that under the VIP, support is available to all veterans with qualifying service, whether or not they have a service-related injury? This means that more veterans will be able to access the services and support provided by Veterans Affairs than ever before. If not, why not?
Mr Speaker, I strongly support the idea that, to the greatest extent possible, that the New Zealand Government would provide independence-type services to veterans, even those who have not been injured or become ill as a result of their service to New Zealand. That is why, referencing my quote to the New Zealand Herald recently, in the first part of the primary question, I stated that it's a great thing to be able to do. It's not a thing that we're able to do, however, at the moment, in the context of the situation we've inherited, to the extent that those resources are taken away from those who have made claims and are waiting up to a year, on average, to receive the help that they need, deserve and are entitled to under the Act.
Further supplementary, what action, if any, has he taken to retain entitlements to the Veterans Independence Program?
Mr Speaker, the scheme continues to exist and we will advocate as much as possible for its continuation. However, on the current parameters, the resources available and as appropriated by the last government, it is not feasible to continue those at the expense of more fundamental core and non-discretionary functions.
Further supplementary, does he believe suspending entitlements to the Veterans Independence Program is acceptable when his government campaigned on ensuring veterans receive care, recognition and support they deserve?
Well, it's more acceptable, Mr Speaker, than the situation that has been allowed to prevail, which many people across the country have raised to me and various local representatives, such that they seek the care that they need, deserve and are legally entitled to under the Veterans Support Act. Clearly there's a prioritisation that has needed to be made. Obviously we will improve the situation as best we can, including by improving the processes, potentially working with non-government agency or organisation partners. For example, I acknowledge the RSA for reaching out and offering such support, and that's something that work that we're actively engaged in.
I'm now to question number 10. The name of Debbie Ngāruhuapeka.
Tēnā koe, Te Pika. Well, my question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by his government's policies and actions?
Right Honourable Winston.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes.
What is his response to the Mana Mokopuna report commissioned by the Ministry of Justice and the National Iwi Chairs Forum, and the rangatahi surveyed called for harsher consequences for racism?
The government's position and my position as the Prime Minister is that I agree with that entirely. When people are racist, they should be called out, fingered, because it's a disaster for democracy. And you know what it looks like and means, don't you?
Point of order, Mr Speaker. Can I please seek clarity on what the last comment from the Prime Minister meant?
Well,
when he said, I know what it looks like.
Sorry,
well, from my perspective, it's not. I didn't understand that they're allowed to ask me questions or answer questions with a question.
Sorry, it's not appropriate to go that way. Ask another question or ask the question again.
What does he see as his role in combating increased racism being experienced by rangatahi according to the Mana Mokopuna report?
The most critical thing that's in the role in terms of combating racism is to point out the fallacy and the deceit and the lie of one people being superior in their DNA to another.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Point of order, Debbie Ngāruhuapeka.
I'd like to bring in the speakers 59/2, 59/4. And 121, the personal reflections, distasteful and disorderly as far as not addressing the real issue here, which is our mokopuna wanting to see a government that addresses racism, not to hear from a Prime Minister who believes that it is his role to tell the person asking the question what a racist is. And I don't think that's what the mokopuna in this report was seeking. If we can just stay focused as the Prime Minister said, and keep the decorum to the kaupapa.
Stay on the point, okay? So your point essentially the point you quote is not something I can rule favourably on. The Prime Minister, in this case, answered the question.
Point of order. The personal reflection is about a reference that was neither made from this person asking the question or this party, and that is the point that I'm making.
I know that, but my point to you is that he did not make a personal reflection. He made a statement in an answer, and that's what the Hansard will show.
My supplementary. Does the Prime Minister agree that education-based solutions are key to combating the increase of racism being experienced by rangatahi at school? And if so, what is his government doing to improve education in this space?
It is the government's position that education and every other utility should be used to combat racism in our society, and we're going to go to the ends of the earth to ensure that that happens.
We come now then to question number 11, the name of Nancy Liu.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Revenue. What announcement has the Minister made on the taxation annual rates for 2023-24, multinational tax and remedial matters bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Last week I announced with the Minister of Finance that the Coalition Government would be introducing an amendment paper to the taxation annual rates for 23-24 multinational tax and remedial matters bill. The amendment paper enacts several changes to the tax system to keep good on our coalition of commitments to ensure New Zealanders can keep more of what they earn. These changes include restoring interest deductibility for residential investment properties and reducing the blight line test from 10 years to 2.
Supplementary. What other changes are included in the government's amendment paper?
Mr. Speaker, the amendment paper closes a loophole that enables offshore online casinos to pay less tax than New Zealand operators. Currently, the only tax that applies to offshore online casinos is GST, where casinos in New Zealand are facing much higher taxes. From the 1st of July, offshore operators will be required to pay a gambling duty of 12% on gross betting revenue, therefore closing this loophole.
Supplementary. When will the other changes come into force?
Mr. Speaker, changes to the bright line test will come into force from the 1st of July 2024 alongside the gambling duty changes. Interest deductibility will be restored in stages, with 80% of a deduction allowed from the 1st of April 2024 and 100% from the 1st of April 2025.
Supplementary,
Nancy Liu.
Has the Minister seen any reports on the bill's treatment of trust tax?
Mr. Speaker, yes. Originally, the bill required many lower income trusts to pay the top tax rate of 39 cents in the dollar. However, I'm pleased to see that the Finance and Expenditure Committee accepted the government's advice for a $10,000 trustee income de minimis to be introduced. This means that around 87% of all trusts in New Zealand are unlikely to be impacted by the change to the top tax rate. This is a sensible and pragmatic change, and I thank the committee for their work.
Chloe Swarbrick.
Why is his government prioritising a $2.9 billion tax cut for landlords over other election promises that would have helped middle-income families and cost less from Crown accounts, like raising the Working for Families abatement threshold?
Mr. Speaker, what is a priority for this government is actually delivering on our coalition agreement and putting downward pressure on rent, and this is what these changes will do.
Question number 12, the name of Shannon Helbert.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. Question to the Minister for Auckland. Does he agree with Christopher Luxon's commitment to Aucklanders in the New Zealand Herald today that the government is ruthlessly focused on rebuilding the economy and reducing the cost of living so more Kiwis can get ahead? If so, what actions will he take to deliver cost of living relief for Aucklanders?
Speaker. The Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
On behalf of the Minister, yes, the government is ruthlessly focused on rebuilding the economy and reducing the cost of living. That is why we are axing the Auckland regional fuel tax on the 30th of June this year, and why the Transport Minister is in Auckland today outlining the Coalition Government's plan to get Auckland moving again.
Supplementary. Is the government's own analysis of the Auckland regional fuel tax repeal correct? that removing the RFT is unlikely to have a substantive impact on households? If not, why not?
Well, I think the member will be pretty aware that when he goes to the petrol station and people pay less money for the petrol because they're not paying a regional fuel tax, they will have more money in their pockets. And that's what we're setting out to achieve.
$1.85. Supplementary. What action is he taking on behalf of Aucklanders who are facing additional public transport costs, registration fees, tolls and or pricing schemes following the repeal of the regional fuel tax?
Well, I'll be saying them that they'll be very pleased that, they'll be very concerned that they're driving around in Auckland, whether they're in cars or on buses, crawling around at 30 kilometres an hour and going over speed bumps everywhere because of the strange priorities of the previous government. And my message to them is help us on its way. You've got a government that's going to actually help them move around more quickly.
Supplementary.
Just wait.
What action is he taking on behalf...
Now you can start.
What action is he taking on behalf of Aucklanders who are facing a proposed 23% increase in their water rates?
Well, it'd be better to ask the Minister for Infrastructure such a question, but we're very focused on ensuring that all Aucklanders get access to things, and that's why we're trying to reduce the pressures, or inflationary pressures in this city, by bringing some discipline back to government spending and by reducing the regulatory burden that many businesses, including the providers of water services in this country, have to deal with. And so long term, we're going to take the pressure off Aucklanders in that regard.
That concludes oral questions.